Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great honor to be here at Field and talk about bank regulation. So this is joint work with Céline Gauthier and Moïse Cissé from the Bank of Canada, who also provided a lot of great data for us that otherwise we wouldn't get. So what motivated us for our talk? Well, in the recent financial crisis, we realized that banks can cause huge negative externalities, both on other banks and on the rest of the economy. And that was one of the reasons why a lot of banks got saved by regulators, because regulators said, oh, we cannot let this bank fail, because otherwise it will there will be a ripple effect, a contagion effect, other banks will fail. So what we heard was that banks are too big to fail or too interconnected to fail. So what's kind of interesting is if this is kind of one of the things that regulators are very concerned about, that this is not really reflected in bank regulation at all. So the capital requirements do not reflect these externalities and are at the moment only based on the risk of the individual bank. So you think about each bank being on an island and regulate the bank on its individual risk and don't consider these interconnections and externalities that a bank failure might bring for all the other banks in the banking system. Regulators keep thinking about how to change that, how to address that. So here's a quote that we have from the U.S. Treasury Secretary, who said that they plan that bigger firms will have to keep more capital and more liquidity on hand, and especially the more interconnected and larger banks should have more capital so that they're safer. Well, this is a kind of a crude approach, but the idea seems to be that regulators start thinking that the capital requirements should not be the same for every bank, but so far it's not so clear how to actually do that. So listening today also to the first talk and recognizing that there's a lot of people from algorithmics here, one motivation that I also came up with is that probably this similar problem applies also within a corporation. If you want to do, take a risk measure for a bank and want to break it down to individual trading desks and say how much of our economic capital that we hold as a bank should we allocate to the credit derivatives trading desk, and we need this capital measure to compute something like return on capital for this division, then the question is how should we do that, especially if divisions can cause externalities for each other, if the credit derivatives desk can cause can create significant losses and then all the other divisions have to sell their assets too at fire sale prices or something like that. So then you create some externalities for other trading desks, and then you come up with a similar problem. So there's been several papers, we're not the first one, that look at how can we take overall risk and allocate that to different banks or trading desks or something like that. There's been a lot of work done on this, but they all assume that there's a given amount of risk that we want to allocate amongst the member banks in the system. I think what our contribution is that we recognize that as soon as you change capital requirements for banks, at the same time default probabilities change, default correlations change, and the overall systemic risk of the system changes. So then you're stuck, so you have to repeat the exercise again until you converge on a fixed point. So we iterate our capital allocation procedure until we reach a fixed point where each capital requirement for each bank equals exactly its risk contribution. So we show that the simple attribution approach, where you take one risk measure and allocate that amongst the banks, can significantly over under adjust your capital requirements. The downside of this is that we need a model, of course, if we want to pursue that way, that tells us how does the capital requirement, the risk change for a bank when we change its capital requirement, and how do these externalities change and default correlations change. So this is our first contribution to find this fixed point. And our second contribution is that we have a very nice data set and try to estimate our model empirically. And we have data for 6 large Canadian banks. And we have access to a unique data on the OTC derivatives exposures between these banks, which is very hard to get usually. And we test whether these macroprudential capital requirements work at all. And we find, yes, they do seem to work very well. They decrease default probabilities for banks by about a quarter. They decrease the probability of a systemic crisis. It works for pretty much all the risk allocation mechanisms that we look at, so there's no specific mechanism that works significantly better than others. These macroprudential capital requirements are not some trivial function of bank size or bank default probability, and we also test for model risk in our paper by having two very different models to measure systemic risk, and we find that if we put the results from one model into the other model, it still works. Which gives us quite a bit of confidence. There's been a big literature out there that looked at contagion and systemic risk. So the first stream of literature looks at contagion mostly in terms of stock markets. So if one market moves, does the other market move? Some papers look at measuring systemic risk specifically for the banking sector. So I've done some work for Austrian banks where we had some very nice data on how much has Bank A borrowed from Bank B. And then we looked at simulating joint loan losses and then looked at how this works out with the joint default probabilities for the banking sector. The other paper cited here is a paper by the Bank of England where they do a similar exercise for the British banking system and try to assess risk there. So this is something regulators really work on, and several regulators in different countries have implemented systems. Then there's several recent papers that also look at new methods to allocate risk to individual member banks in the banking system, and this all is kind of integrated also in the a little bit in the theory of systemic risk. So Ellen and Gale's paper is very famous in analyzing how contagion works in an interbank network and how interbank connections can be used for risk sharing. We'll rely a little bit on the work of Shin, who comes up with these fire sales, where you say that if one bank is in trouble, they start selling assets that brings down the asset value for all the other banks as well in the banking system, so they are constrained and they start selling assets. And then I want to advertise my own paper a little bit where we use a different approach where we look at these network models of interbank connections, but then we introduce bargaining. If one bank cannot pay its obligations, then they'll go and start bargaining with each other. And we want to look at how these contracts can be renegotiated within a banking system and under what conditions can renegotiations fail and how do banks ex-ante compensate for the possibility of failures in interbank in renegotiations. By the way, if you have any questions along the way, feel free to ask them. I'm very happy to answer questions as we go along. So in our model, we define a set of bank capital holding C, and then we come up with our model of getting a loss distribution L. Then we allocate these losses. From these losses, we allocate the risk of the system with some risk allocation rule F. And what we define as a consistent capital allocation is that the risk allocation, given the macroprudential capital requirements, has to equal the macroprudential capital requirements. So we want to find a consistent capital allocation where each bank holds capital that equals its contribution to the overall risk. So this is a fixed point problem, and the downside would we probably have to work with what other authors that just look empirically at this problem don't have to do it. We have to come up with a model that tells us how does the loss distribution in the banking system change when we change capital in the system. So we look at several risk allocation mechanisms. The first two are fairly well known in the literature. This is just can be found in Chorion's Value at Risk book. So we look at component value at risk. So essentially what we do is we estimate the beta of the losses of a bank with respect to the aggregate losses in the banking system. And the nice property of this component value at risk is that all the risk contributions for each bank add up to the risk of the total banking system. The second method we use is incremental value at risk, where we look at the VAR for the whole banking system, and then we take out one bank out of the banking system and look at the value at risk, how the value at risk changes then, and the incremental value at risk is the value at risk of all the banks minus the value at risk if we take out bank I. The downside of this is that the risk contributions don't add up to the overall risk of the banking system, and so we rescale all the incremental values at risk such that they match the total capital in the system. The reason we do that is that we don't want to get in a policy debate on how much capital should the banking sector as an aggregate hold. That's more or less a policy decision, and the more capital you hold, the safer you are, but this is not our primary concern. We want to see how should we allocate the existing capital in the banking system on the individual member banks. The Bank of International Settlements in Basel proposed recently, or pursues very aggressively, to propose Shapley values as an allocation mechanism. Shapley values come from cooperative game theory, where you say where you have players that have a resource and you can combine the resources to create something valuable, and how should this value that you create be allocated to the individual players. It can also be seen as a outcome of a non-cooperative bargaining game. Here we look at how is the risk of the total system and how much does each bank contribute to the risk of the system. What we need to do that for that is we need to have some kind of value function that defines some kind of risk measure for a subset of banks, B, and then we say, we look at these incremental changes here again and say how much does for any subset B the risk change if we add bank I to the set of banks, and we weigh that by these factors to come up with the Shapley value for each bank. One thing we have to watch out for is that this function V, in order for the Shapley value to be well defined, should be increasing, and which works out well in our sample, and we don't run into any problems here. So what value function V do we use? We either allocate for each subset of banks again the value at risk, or we use the expected tail loss as risk measures, V for a subset of banks. The last allocation rule that we look at is called Delta Covar and was advocated by Adrian and Brunemeyer very recently. And what they look at is how much does the risk of the system change when one bank realizes a severe loss. And since we measure our model by simulation, they use quantile regression to approximate, to come up with this risk measure. Since our measure is simulation-based, what we look at is if one bank realizes a loss that's very close to the value at risk of that bank, how much, what is the loss, what is the value at risk of the banking system in this stage, and we subtract from that the loss, the value at risk of the banking system if bank I realizes a return that corresponds roughly to the median return for its return distribution. The basic idea is, what can we learn about the risk of the system when bank I is in trouble? These are the risk allocation mechanisms that we use. The next thing I want to quickly introduce is the model that we use to measure how risk the risk of the banking system works out. So we have banks, model banks as nodes in the network, where we have having banks have outside assets A, which consists of two parts, some liquid assets. The liquid assets can always be sold for a price of one, and then there's some illiquid assets that have a price P, which will be endogenously determined depending on how much of the illiquid assets other banks put in the market. The banks finance these assets with senior liabilities on D that we can see as deposits that banks raise from depositors. And then banks have interbank assets and interbank liabilities to other banks in the network. We model two sources of contagion. The first one is through the price P of the illiquid assets. As banks hit the regulatory constraint, they start selling assets. What that means is that for all the other banks, the value of their assets goes down as the price decreases. So the other banks start selling assets as well, and that can create the fire sale situation where banks sell more and more assets. The second source of contagion can be through these interbank assets and liabilities. If some banks are not able to repay their honor their promised payments in the interbank market, then these banks go into default, and this can create some problems for other member banks in the system. So the network model determines the interbank payments in a bankruptcy situation. What we do if a bank cannot honor its obligation, it defaults, the assets are reduced by some bankruptcy cost, phi, and whatever remains, the depositors are paid off first, and if some money is left, then the claimants on the interbank market get paid on a pro rata basis, so whatever assets are left gets allocated to the junior claimants on the interbank market. We can then define a clearing payment vector that solves for us the clearing in the interbank market. It's consistent with the bankruptcy rules and limited liability, so if there's no assets left, then the banks pay nothing. And we use a fixed point. This is again a nested fixed point problem where we use an algorithm that was developed by Eisenberg and Nowy to solve for these clearing problems in a network of interbank obligations. The second source of contagion that we have in our model are asset fire sales, where we have these liquid assets that banks have, which are fine, and then there's these illiquid assets, and we think about those as loans to corporations or corporate bonds that banks have, and banks have to hold a capital charge against these assets. If the banks sell these assets, they get cash, and cash has no capital charge in the regulation. So when the banks go and sell these assets, they can improve their regulatory capital ratio because they swap illiquid assets against cash. But as banks approach their minimum capital requirement, they all start selling assets, and then the price of the assets is determined by how much banks in aggregate sell into the market, and this price has an effect on the balance sheet of all the other banks in the systems as all banks mark their assets to market, and this might trigger fire sales in other banks, and we could have a downward spiral in these asset prices, and banks sell more assets. What data do we have? We simulate loan losses to these banks in the banking system. So we have a snapshot of the bank's loan portfolios as of May 2008, and we model a systematic shock to all the banks, and this is taken from a IMF stress test with the Bank of Canada that was done and as a part of the financial stability exercise that all countries do with the IMF on a regular basis. So they simulated a stress scenario for different sectors in the economy, and we draw 10,000 of these macro stress scenarios, and these are important to introduce correlation amongst banks. So if in a stress scenario the housing sector is hit hard, then all the banks suffer a loss from the housing sector, depending on how much exposure each bank has to the housing sector. So we got some data from the Bank of Canada of how much each bank has invested in each industry, and we use this to model expected losses. On top of these expected losses, we have idiosyncratic shocks that each bank gets hit with, and we have data on the distribution of the loan sizes from the Bank of Canada and the from OSFI, and we then use a credit risk plus model to simulate idiosyncratic loan losses in for each bank based on this macro scenario. And we draw 100 idiosyncratic loan losses per macro scenario, so we have overall 1 million loan losses that we work with, and our model is then solved by simulation. What is kind of unique for us, and not many regulators or countries have that, is that we got lucky and have detailed data on the OTC derivatives exposure of Canadian banks with each other, because OSFI conducted a survey for the banks, and we were lucky to get the data. When we look at trying to estimate all the other data on the interbank exposure, we have a problem because banks only report how much in aggregate they owe to other banks and how other Canadian banks, and how much they should get from other Canadian banks. So if we think about the matrix of interbank exposures, we have a 6x6 matrix, and what we know are the row sums and the column sums, how much each bank has borrowed in aggregate and lent in aggregate from other banks. We know that that diagonal is zero because no bank borrows from itself, and so we have to kind of estimate the matrix of interbank exposures given the information that we have. What we do for that is we try to spread out the interbank obligations evenly and use entropy maximization algorithm to estimate the 6x6 matrix of interbank obligations. It works quite well. We try to use some other heuristics where we said, oh, we want to maximize concentration in the interbank lending market, and the results are not substantially different that we got. We also have data on cross-shareholdings. Canadian banks surprisingly hold quite a substantial equity stakes in other banks, probably for trading purposes or other reasons, and we have data on those as well because they also present an exposure to other banks in the system. So here's a little bit of an overview of how the different parts are important for interbank lending. So if you look at traditional lending, interbank loans are still the most important part of interbank obligations in Canada. So we have here as a percentage of Tier 1 capital, there are some banks that have 38% of the interbank of their Tier 1 capital as lent out to other banks. Derivatives exposures are not as big. Some banks have no exposure at all. Other banks have about 21% of their capital as exposure on OTC derivatives. Cross-shareholdings are kind of there too, but also not that huge. On average, banks have 26% of their Tier 1 capital on the interbank, as exposure on the interbank market. Compared to other countries, especially in Europe, this is not so much. In Europe, we see sometimes banks having 20% of their total assets on the interbank market. So here they have 26% of their capital on the interbank market, and capital is usually 10% of assets, so it's not so big. We also use a second model, which is completely different for robustness checks, and for that we use a simple Merton model. So we take stock price data from 2006 to 2008 and use a maximum likelihood estimator that was developed at Dwan to estimate the market value of the assets and the volatility of the assets from the equity prices. So this should capture the idea what a lot of people propagate, that the market knows better than the regulator what's going on between the banks, and we hope to capture part of that with that model. On the downside, of course, if you look at market data, it also includes the anticipated actions of the regulators. So if everybody believes that the regulator will bail out the banks, the stock price will not reach zero, but will always stay positive because it anticipates the regulatory action. But anyway, so in Canada, the problem is not so severe because no bank really went bankrupt. So we hope to get some correlation, pick up some market-induced correlation by that. We then reduce all asset values by 5% because we want to be roughly consistent in default probabilities with the IMF stress test scenario, and then simulate asset values using a Kolesky decomposition of the covariance matrix. So default occurs in the simple Merton framework when the market simulated market value of the assets is less than total liability. So this is kind of our robustness check model. In the paper, you see that we did all the exercises for both models. I will present to you mostly the results from the network model today, and then see how the results from the network model do in the Merton model as a robustness check for model risk. So here we have our six Canadian banks, which I'm not allowed to identify. And we have here the changes from these macro potential capital requirements as a percentage of Tier 1 capital. So we see that these macro potential capital requirements can differ quite a bit, up to 25% from observed current capital requirements. What we do see is that two banks here, under all models, no matter which model you use, should have more capital. So bank 6 and bank 4 should, under all models, under all kind of risk allocation rules, increase their capital levels, versus banks 3 and 5 should decrease, or should be allowed to decrease their capital that they hold under all capital mechanisms. How does that correlate with different activities? Well, with a sample of 6 banks, we cannot do an elaborate econometric analysis, so the only thing we can do is look at correlations. So if we look at first, what's kind of interesting is what is it not correlated to, and if you remember the Geithner quote at the beginning, he was saying that the banks that are larger should have more capital. Well, we don't find any significant correlation between changes in capital requirements and size. So this is insignificant. Also, the default probability is not really significant related to the change in capital requirements. Macro potential capital requirements are more complicated because they also take default correlations into account. What seems to be significant are interbank assets, with the idea that the more interconnected banks are more subject to exposure from these externalities and this contagion effect, so they should have more capital. And what's also kind of interesting is the Tier 1 capital over total assets is positively correlated with macro potential capital requirements. So for that, we're not too sure of. Either it is that we could look at this as a simple leverage ratio, and Canada is unique compared to the U.S. that they ask banks not to exceed a certain leverage ratio. Probably that's a good thing, and that's one way to look at this. The other way is to the causality goes the other way around. These banks know that they should have more capital, and that's why they hold higher levels of Tier 1 capital relative to their total assets, because they know they are more kind of pose a greater threat to the banking system. We don't really know how the causality works or why we find that this is highly significant. So if we look at bank default probabilities in our network model, we have here Default probabilities for all the banks under the observed capital requirements. This is what they have right now. But in a way, that might be an unfair comparison because banks might just have recently issued equity and then they show that they have right now a higher capital ratio than they're probably required to have. So as a second benchmark, computers called what we call Basel Equal, where all banks have the same regulatory capital requirements. So we take the given capital in the banking system and spread that out evenly so that all banks have the same regulatory capital requirement. And then we look at the default probabilities under the macro potential capital requirements in all these models. So what we see is that the banks that under the macro potential requirement, capital requirements are required to hold more capital. This works. When they hold more capital, we see that the default probabilities go down. So that is bank 6 and bank number 4. So right now, under the observed capital, they have 11% and 10% default probability. Under these macro potential capital requirements, we see that their default probability goes down significantly. What's kind of interesting as well is that these banks that are allowed to reduce their capital requirements, their default probability does not go up. So banks 3 and 5 under the macro potential capital requirements have about the same default probability or even a little bit less than before, even though they are allowed to reduce their capital requirements by quite a bit. So it's not that you make some banks less risky at the expense of others. It seems that these macro potential capital requirements do a good job of reducing risk for everybody. If we look at average default probabilities, we see that while currently the average default probability is 9%, and remember this is given a stress test, and I don't want to say that get in big trouble with the Bank of Canada if Canadian banks do not default with a 9% probability, that is under a severe stress scenario. But we see that these macro potential capital requirements seem to do a good job in reducing default probability amongst the board for all banks. So here we have the probability of multiple bank defaults. So these rows give us the probability that one bank defaults, any two banks default, up to all banks defaulting. What we see if we look at the default probabilities, these are kind of a little bit U-shaped. So there's either a chance that one or two banks default, the chance that three or four default is fairly low, and then you have a little bit more probability mass on the event that five or six banks default. The reason comes from these the contagion and the fire sales. So the system can absorb the default of one bank, maybe two banks, but once three banks start getting in trouble, then these fire sales and contagion kicks in and they wipe out all the other banks. And so that's why we rarely see three or four banks defaulting. So it's either one or two or all of them. Down here, we have the probability that more than five banks default, and we see that's pretty high. Two. So what happens in these macro potential capital requirements? We see that the probability of a crisis, no matter how you define it, if you define it that all six banks default or that four or more banks default, the probability of a crisis seems to decrease under pretty much all of these micropotential allocation mechanisms. It doesn't matter too much which one you use. It seems that all of them do a fairly good job at reducing the probability of a systemic crisis. Again, this is not driven by a very simple fact because we don't see that the default occurrence of one bank being in default goes up. You could argue that all that the macro potential capital requirements do is just reduce the default correlation. And if you reduce default correlation, sure, you have fewer instances where all the banks default. But here we see that we also don't have an increase in the occurrences where only one bank defaults. So this table, in this table we want to illustrate how important it is to go and solve for the fixed point versus doing a simple risk attribution analysis. So here we measure the difference between the capital requirements and the risk attribution analysis and the fixed point, the macroprudential capital requirements as a percentage of Tier 1 capital. So we have to present everything in relative terms so that we cannot identify individual banks. But we see that if you do the fixed point, you can be quite far off. If you don't do the fixed point, but just do a simple risk attribution analysis, you can be off by quite a bit, especially here under this Delta Cova methodology. But also under the other methodologies, you can be away by 7, 8, up to 20% of your changes in capital requirements. We just stop at the first iteration, right? So that's what a lot of papers do right now in the literature. They just do one iteration and say, this is our measure of risk in the banking system, and we just apply incremental valued risk as a one shot. But if you want to do this thoroughly and think about these changes, then this makes quite a big difference. So here we test for model risk, and this is really a very tough test. If you think about it, we take this network model, which is based on accounting data, and report the data to the central bank, which is based on this fire sales and the credit risk model, and take the results from this and put it in this Merton model, which is completely different based on stock prices. And what we do see is that still these macro potential capital requirements don't reduce systemic risk or default probabilities by that much, but they still do seem to reduce them at least a little bit, which is kind of, in our opinion at least, still somewhat remarkable, given that this is a very strong test on model risk, and we still find that these macro potential capital requirements under the network model also seem to work in a very different setting. The last thing we did is we looked a little bit out of sample to some empirical observations after our date. So we looked at how much, after we did our calculations, how much capital have banks raised between June 2008 and September 2009, which is kind of in the financial crisis. We looked at losses in equity value, and we also looked at the maximum loss that the stock price had of all these bank stocks afterwards. And we find that there's those banks that should have more capital, macro potential capital requirement, on average raised more capital, and that they also suffered from larger losses in stock prices during the financial crisis. So to summarize, what we believe is important in bank regulation, what has not been included so far in the regulatory process, is that banks can create these negative externalities for the system, and we could address this with using these macro potential capital requirements. We do find that bank macro potential capital requirements seem to work. They can reduce the individual bank default probability as well as the probability of a systemic crisis. It's not so important what you do, which mechanism you implement, as long as you do something about it, you seem to be able to regulate banks in a better way. Implementation of this will be somewhat hard in practice if you have two kids and you know, why does he get something that I don't get? That's the problem that you'll have. So why does the other bank have to have a different capital requirement than I have? And this will be something that's probably hard to implement in practice, because banks will complain, But nevertheless, if we want to move forward and address systemic risk and capital regulation, this is something we have to do. We see this sometimes in the U.S., for example, deposit insurance premiums are set by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and they have some discretion on the rate. So part of it is based on capital statistics, but part of it is discretion, and this is probably one way to address this problem, is to give discretion to the regulator and say, look, you should just hold more capital because you're more important for the system. Okay, thank you. Yep. Canada did okay, yes. Canada did very well. Well, on average, the bank regulations are pretty homogeneous across the world. So it's not so much true that Canadian banks are regulated in a very different way than American banks, and that's the reason why Canada did better. So I think that the capital requirements and the rules are pretty homogeneous around the world. You could, if you get the hard part for testing this is getting the right data. So, especially on these interbank connections, that's very hard to get. So for Canada, we were lucky to get the data. That's partly of the motivation why we tested our model or applied our model to a set of Canadian banks.
So, I would say that the regulation is the same, but the U.S. had a large factor of their banking system that was not great. Canada didn't have a shadow.
I don't want to compare Canada and the U.S. I think this is totally problematic for banks for different orders.
My completely unscientific personal comment on this, which is very much not what the Bank of Canada thinks, is there's two basic reasons. One is that the Canadian banks are slow to catch on, so it saves them a lot of trouble. And my second opinion is that the Canadian banks are in such a comfortable oligopoly where they can earn truckloads of cash from consumers because of a lack of competition, that they didn't have to go there and invest in all the risky projects because their charter value is so high from just being around that they can extract so much money that there's less of an incentive to get into the riskier business. But that's my unrepresentative. That's partly my my personal opinion, at least. Yes. Well, you have to have co-authors in the bank, otherwise you don't get that. And during the process, we went through a crisis because some senior official had to sign off on allowing us to publish the paper, and then after we've invested a lot of time in writing this and implementing everything, they decided, oh, maybe we should not publish this, which created a little bit of a crisis for me. Then I threatened to write the competing paper where I leave the Bank of Canada data out but name the banks by name. And I don't know, to some tough bargaining, we were allowed to publish the paper. And I mean, I mostly in academic circles, the data is old, so I don't think you can really... their concern is, of course, that some journalists will come along and say, wow, the Bank of Canada says the default probability is 9%, right, on average for Canadian banks. So, and then they have to defend this, right? So that's I think, their concern, which is very legitimate, because they don't want to create a panic or something. But now that things are smoothed out, knowing that this is old data, and this is an academic paper, which hopefully no journalist will ever read. So, because they find it too boring, so then I hope we don't generate a lot of attention.
I remind you of being recorded, so all this is on the record.
Oh, okay. Well, there's been a lot of literature on this charter value in the 80s, where you think about how do you motivate banks by giving them some economic grants to mitigate their incentives to take risk. And certainly, if you limit competitions, then banks have a strong incentive to be around next year, because then they can earn some rents from that. And the question is this kind of, from a welfare perspective, a good or a bad thing? Oligopoly rents are a bad thing on the one hand. On the other hand, having a stable banking system is also value for society. And if you make sure that they don't create risk, that's a good thing too. I think we cannot really answer that question, but it certainly has some benefit to allow banks some economic grants. And we do see that it's not easy. Banking is not free entry, right? We cannot go and say, oh, we'll start a bank tomorrow, right? There is, in all countries around the world, there's hurdles to entry into the banking system. And that's partly because of this idea of creating charter values. That's something, it's a very complicated question. I mean, in Germany we see that they have a lot of small savings banks which are very active in competition. They bring down prices and reduce competition for the big, reduce profits for the big banks. So yes, there's certainly something to say that charter values are lower when you have more banks. And it's a very hard decision to make, how big you want to have your banking system.
You guys are asking that question?
No, we don't have questions, but we really enjoyed the talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any more questions from you? In that case, thank you. Thanks, both speakers.
Thank you.